Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We got 5 days in this economy, of course, because it's Friday. We've got digital currency, and we got the shoes on your feet as economic indicator. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the 21st of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But it kind of feels like the news center of gravity is shifting back to the political and away from the economic. So we are going to set that straight right now. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you, if I could, and the minutes of the Federal Reserve's most recent meeting, which were out this week, in which they said that they are ready to start talking about withdrawing support for this economy. I need you to help folks understand why that matters and what the effect might be.
Right. So one important detail here is that it was a number of Fed officials saying that they were thinking that if we saw rapid progress in the economy in the upcoming, you know, weeks and months, that it would be appropriate to start a conversation about pulling back bond buying. And so I think the things to emphasize are it's a number, it's not all of them. And so we're not sure how widespread this agreement is. And it seems like it probably doesn't include Jay Powell, the Fed chair. Hmm. And so that's an important caveat. That said, it's clear that there is some portion of the committee, and a substantial portion of the committee, given the qualification of number, that is kind of getting ready to sort of dial back these bond purchases. And that's really important because they have not only been helping the economy, but have really been propping up asset prices and helping the stock market. And so I think when you see that conversation start, the Fed is very attuned to sort of hinting it's coming, and getting people really ready for it to begin so that the bottom doesn't fall out from under markets, like we saw in the taper tantrum episode after the global financial crisis, when Ben Bernanke kind of hinted that they were going to talk about tapering and markets went nuts. So we're basically trying to avoid a repeat.
Yeah. So, Sudeep, let me ask you this. I mean, Jay Powell has been saying explicitly, and this is why I gave the whole talking about thing. He literally said, we are not talking about raising interest rates. I wonder how much the chair has maybe painted himself into a corner here.
He's going to be talking about nothing for for a long time. He's really trying hard and so far succeeding in not freaking out markets and freaking out businesses and leading to a huge spike in interest rates, which is what he's trying to avoid since their policy is for lower interest rates. But eventually the reckoning will come. We know there will be some hit to the stock market. You have huge swaths of the market that are built around low interest rates, ultra low interest rates for a long time. And Jay Powell's dream scenario right now is that you see those market interest rates start to climb just as the economy is at its best, because he doesn't want to be pulling that back when the economy is struggling. He wants to be pulling it back when you're in kind of a Goldilocks scenario.
Right. Okay. Slight change of gears here, Gina, to Chair Powell's predecessor, now Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, who went to the Chamber of Commerce this week and gave a speech in which she said, among many other things, we really think corporate America ought to help pay for our infrastructure plan. And it did not go over well. The CEO of the chamber came out immediately afterwards and said, we love infrastructure. We just think we ought to pay for it in a different way. And I'd love your sense on how that whole exchange went.
Yeah, right. I think if you're going to give those particular set of comments, that is a tough crowd to choose to deliver it to. She went before all of the biggest companies in America and basically said, you guys should try a little harder to help the economy here. But yeah, it was a really interesting speech because she basically said two things. You know, A, corporations need to do their share and pay their part to make sure that we can have a prosperous economy. And also that workers needed to be more unionized, or that being more unionized could potentially help workers to kind of gain back their power. Neither thing is particularly friendly toward the business community. And as you said, both received a pretty quick and earnest response from the chamber itself.
It's worth pointing out here, Sudeep, that the White House apparently this afternoon came out and said, hey, you know, maybe we don't need $2.3 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. Maybe we only need $1.7 trillion. So negotiations, it seems, on the size of this package are proceeding.
Well, yeah, and the White House is trying to move around some of the things that it wants into other bills that are more likely to pass. And this is all, it seems like a shell game at times, but this is all an exercise to just see where is the bipartisan support. Are there things that everybody would vote for, and under what conditions? Like, does it have to be deficit spending, or does it have to be paid for? There are all sorts of pieces of this that people on both sides of the aisle would generally accept, but not in this giant package. Yeah. And that's what they're going through, is they're going through this exercise, which is partly theater, and they all know it, but partly because there is a very real need for infrastructure. It's just nobody can agree on what is infrastructure, how much should be spent, or over what period. So just a few things that need to be worked out.
Yeah, just a little bit. Gina, real quick, I do want to touch on another proposal out of the Treasury Department this week, the idea that Secretary Yellen has, obviously on behalf of her boss, for a global minimum tax. The Treasury Department came out this week and said, you know, we could do 15% globally. And it runs into a whole political thicket, both here in this country, but also overseas, because incentives matter, right? Companies, you know, are going to go where the tax rates are lower.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, I think this really comes back to the idea you raised earlier, which is how do you make companies sort of pay their share in a, you know, prosperous economy. And part of that is making sure that companies can't just move abroad and not pay taxes if we increase taxes here. And so they came out with this 15% number, which was actually a little bit lower than expected, but I think kind of sent the signal that, you know, they're ready to negotiate. Mm-hmm. That said, they also came out and said this 15% is a floor, not a ceiling. And so I think this is going to be a real sort of, you know, I read someone putting it as sort of like the multi-trillion-dollar question is like, how do they in fact keep it at 15%, and do other companies sign on to that, or other countries sign on to that? Because it's not obvious that the rest of the world is going to get behind this, although the administration seems to think that this is something that they can get some sort of agreement on.
It's a talking point. All right, very tight 6 minutes today. We got to go. Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, a little bit up, a little bit down, a little bit unchanged. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, speaking of the Fed, as we were there for a little bit, kind of out of nowhere yesterday, the Fed released a video of Chair Powell talking about a central bank digital currency, a digital dollar, if you will. The Fed has been thinking about a CBDC, Powell said, a central bank digital currency. They are going to keep on thinking about it, and they're going to come out with a white paper this summer about what they have been thinking about it. Yes, a tad confusing, both what the Fed is talking about and what a digital dollar might actually be. We grant you that. And that is why Marketplace's Sabri Benishore got the call this morning.
A central bank digital currency is kind of like Bitcoin, minus the chaos and the volatility.
It would be issued and backed by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Jim Angel teaches at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. Bitcoin's value can change by the second. A central bank digital dollar would be, and would always be, just a dollar.
Imagine smart money. Imagine programmable money. Imagine money that you could send to your nephew, but he could only spend it on textbooks at college. Imagine being able to track what the charity did with the money you donated.
About 80% of central banks worldwide are exploring a central bank digital currency, according to a report by Bison Trails. One of the basic questions, what exactly would they do with it? Paul Graywall is the chief legal officer at Coinbase.
Will they allow speculation or investment in the assets, or will they simply limit it to payments and payments alone?
Graywall says the other big question is how anonymous should this thing be? David Treat is a senior managing director at Accenture. He says take, by comparison, paper money.
If I'm at the corner store and I slide a $10 bill across to the store owner, I'm not sharing any identity information in that transaction.
The central bank digital dollar could be just as anonymous, but with legal exceptions.
With the triggers that suddenly then the identity information could be reported.
Different countries will come up with different rules and different levels of privacy. China is a first mover in developing this kind of digital currency, says Georgetown's Jim Angel.
It will give the Chinese government unparalleled views of exactly what their people are spending money on, and it will give the Chinese government the ability to shut off people's wallets.
By contrast, Europe is developing a version with certain privacy controls, says Angel. If the U.S. wants the dollar to continue to be the most useful currency in the world, he says, it'll have to catch up. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We try on this program as best we can to use and relate to you economic indicators that are useful and relevant. And sure, we do the Baltic Dry Index every now and then and leading economic indicators too, but sometimes you just want a good solid glimpse inside the consumer mind. So with that, today, dress shoes. A couple of shoe companies reported profits this week, including Shoe Carnival. The chain said dress shoe sales are up triple digits compared to this time last year. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra is on the economic indicator desk today.
Rick Lee owns a shoe store in New York called Sola. And he says dress shoes are one of those things that people pretty much stopped buying during the pandemic.
That business for the past year has been basically underwater.
But over the past month, he's suddenly selling heels and ballet flats and loafers for customers to wear to weddings and bat mitzvahs.
So I think that seems to be a good, you know, indicator that the economy is slowly getting back to where it was before.
Here's the thing about dress shoes. You don't really wear them around the house. They're meant to be seen by other people. And so they could be a sign now, not necessarily of whether the economy will recover, but
how the economy will recover.
That's Tiffany Hogan at the consulting firm Kantar. She says with people buying a lot of dress shoes,
maybe it's more of an indicator that, you know, life is returning to more of some level of normalcy.
That people are hosting and attending events, for instance. Shoe Carnival has been tracking this on a granular level. CEO Cliff Sifford says the company has seen a big jump in sales of what it calls social dress shoes.
That would be all the evening shoes, anything with glitz or glamour. Then you have pumps and open sandals.
So shoes meant for celebrations. Like any good indicator, we can track dress shoes over time. And in a couple months, sales of the more office-appropriate styles could tell us something else. How many people are going back in? And do they feel the need to dress up anymore? I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You don't have to count cash drawers. You don't have to do bank runs.
Well, that's a relief, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 123. Today, that is 0.3%. Closed at 34,207, did the blue chips. NASDAQ went the other way, down 64 points, about 0.4%. Finished at 13,470. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, basically flat, 41.55. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gave back 0.5%. The NASDAQ grew 0.3%. S&P 500 to the downside, 0.4%. As Marielle was telling us, people are buying fancy shoes for special occasions again. Shoe Carnival up 4.2%. Steve Madden fell 1.9%. We've been telling you about grain and other farm commodities are more expensive right now. That uptick has helped the larger ag business. John Deere, the farm equipment maker, released second quarter profits today. Shares grew 1.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Biden signed an executive order this week telling government agencies to get ready for the effects of climate change on our financial system, the economy, and everybody in it, homeowners, consumers, businesses, and the federal government itself. Now, one might fairly ask at this point, as one observes that a whole lot of Fortune 500 companies have been planning for and working to mitigate their risk from a warming planet for a good long while, one might fairly ask, the federal government's just catching on now? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went in search of answers.
Some companies are listing climate change risks in their annual reports. Others are setting goals for zero carbon emissions. Stephen Rothstein tracks this at Ceres, a nonprofit that works with investors and businesses on sustainability.
The largest banks in the last 6 months have all said that they're going to be net zero by 2050.
Rothstein says most medium and large-sized companies are doing something about climate change, although he says that doesn't mean they're doing enough. And some businesses are already feeling the impact of climate change, like insurers. Tracy Lewis at the environmental group 350.org says some are refusing to cover homes in fire-prone areas.
They can predict the losses, and they know that they will not be able to recover the monies that they have to continue to pay out for complete destruction.
President Biden told federal agencies to report back on steps they're taking to regulate the financial risk of climate change. Stuart Glickman, an analyst at CFRA Research, says they'll start by following businesses' lead.
Following is easier. Leading takes more consensus.
Glickman says whatever regulators do, it'll give companies some certainty about climate change regulations, something they've been asking for. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The upfronts came to a close this week. Once upon a time, they were a chance for television networks to trot out their executives and their stars and try to convince advertisers to pony up and buy time on their fall lineups. It was, back then, just a week. But now there are upfronts for digital media, podcasts. The whole thing lasts a whole lot longer than a week, I'll tell you that. Last year's presentations were canceled. This year's were remote. So in order to get a sense of what else has changed, we got A.J. Christian on the phone. He's a professor of communications at Northwestern. And I asked him, with more and more content companies trying to get advertisers' attention and their money, does he think this whole upfront thing is getting more diluted?
They might have been diluted, but I think it was necessary. There's no way that in 2021, four networks were going to be able to carry the demand for high-quality advertising placements. And so upfronts had to expand. I think the new fronts, when they started, was definitely a challenge to the upfronts. And now it seems like both have been accepted as part of the same kind of broad, overall, now probably two-month event.
Right. New fronts. You should probably define that term, too.
The new fronts are the digital equivalent of the upfronts. They started when companies like YouTube were trying to get advertisers to commit their big dollars to online advertising, which is delivered in a much different way than traditional advertising.
Right. So let me ask you about the actual delivery of content. So much of it now comes from streamers, right? Netflix, Disney Plus, Paramount. I mean, take your pick. And I guess my question is, why do those companies need to lure advertisers?
So not all of them need to lure advertisers. Some of those companies have a combination of subscription and advertising. So Discovery Plus has on-demand subscription programming, but you can also watch House Hunters live 24/7 with ad breaks through the Discovery Plus app. In the digital space and in this new streaming universe, there's a ever-diversifying array of options.
I don't know if I'm sticking around for House Hunters if I have to stick around through ads. That's all I'm saying. I'll watch it in one, I'll watch it in one whack for 22 minutes or whatever it is. We should also point out that we are now able, advertisers are able, and also programmers, to target very specific audiences. There were black upfronts this year as well, right?
There were black upfronts with some of Byron Allen's companies. Mm-hmm. There is Univision for Latinx content. There's even a fan-driven, it's not really an upfront, but there's like a fan-driven queer upfront happening as well. So yes, diverse audiences are in this year. That's kind of a new thing. But historically through the new fronts, you were getting some specific audiences as well, fashion audiences, women's publications. So this is, I think, part of a broader diversification of the upfronts that's been happening for several years now.
Yeah. Do you think, just as a way to sort of play this forward a little bit, last year the upfronts were canceled because obviously the pandemic. This year they were virtual. It's not cheap to get all those television stars and TikTok stars and what have you stars to Radio City in New York or wherever they decide to hold them. Do you think they stay virtual and people just try to do the easy thing?
We will see. I think it's going to be all about what the advertising call is. For many decades, it was seen as necessary to bring people to New York to do the schmoozing, the meeting the stars in order to get those multi-billion dollar commitments. If they can get those commitments at a lower price, they certainly need the money in a very competitive media landscape right now.
Professor A.J. Christian at Northwestern University. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sabri did the whole digital currency, cryptocurrency story a couple of minutes ago, but there is room as well, I think, for a cashless economy story, because we are doing that more and more. Venmo and its peer-to-peer payment app colleagues paying for food, for instance, in an app. And yes, we did all that before the pandemic, but a report from Square not too long ago, the digital payment company, shows the number of businesses that don't accept actual cash money anymore has doubled in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and the U.K. since February of last year. And as Benjamin Gottlieb from KCRW reports, there is a good chance those numbers could keep on rising.
It's lunchtime at Dune Restaurant in Los Angeles. About a half dozen chefs and staff hustle to fill orders. Hummus plates, falafel wraps, and lamb kofta. Like many businesses in L.A., this restaurant has taken extra precautions during the last 15 months. Tables are set up on the sidewalk patio. Customers can't enter the building. They've got to order over intercom. And the only payments accepted here are either electronic or plastic.
Would you like to include an optional tip or I can include?
You don't have to count cash drawers. You don't have to switch out cash drawers midway through the day. You don't need to do bank runs.
That's Simon Pond, the operations manager at Dune. He says the restaurant stopped using cash based on recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year. At the time, the decision was based on safety, but there have been some other benefits too, so Dune may stay cashless.
We are a very high-volume restaurant, and for a customer to be fluffing around with their wallet and maybe some even trying to give you the precise change, if you can just tap your phone, you're done, you're out, and we can attend to the next customer.
This restaurant is among a fast-growing segment of the U.S. economy that's ditching paper money entirely. That's according to a report by Square, the digital payment company. It estimates around 18% of businesses that use its service in the U.S. are currently cash-free. The pandemic put digital payments in hyperdrive, says Shelley Santana, a professor at Bentley University in Massachusetts who studies the cash-free economy.
We got to where we are today 3 years faster than we would have gotten had it not been for COVID-19.
And it's not just small businesses, Santana says, that are trying out cashless payments because of the pandemic.
If you look at a lot of the sports stadiums, many, many, many of them are going cashless.
From Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta to Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. And yes, here in Los Angeles at Dodgers Stadium. Baseball caps, hot dogs, you can't buy those things with cash anymore. Cash-to-card kiosks are set up around the ballpark if you've left your card at home or if you don't have one. In L.A., this trend also has the support of its local politicians, including Mayor Eric Garcetti.
I think the forces predate the pandemic to be contactless and electronic, and we've got to make sure that everybody has access to that.
L.A. did not have an official position on companies going cashless a couple years ago, but some cities did. New York City, Philadelphia, and San Francisco all passed laws banning cash-free businesses. Politicians there warned about equity issues. Not everyone has access to a credit card or a bank account.
No, I'm sorry, we're only accepting card and Apple Pay.
Some customers, like Fern Laurel at Dune, say they're simply not comfortable using a credit card for every transaction.
You know, being out there constantly using it, I do feel a little bit vulnerable.
That sentiment is why Christine De La Cruz, who runs a Filipino-American dessert bakery called Creme Caramel in L.A., has decided not to make her business cash-free permanently. She did for months during the pandemic, but began accepting paper money again recently.
We still have customers who still want to use it.
But those transactions, she says, make up less than 10% of her business. And that's on a good day. In Los Angeles, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which seems like a totally good idea with just a hint of what could possibly go wrong mixed in. The White House said today it's working with a bunch of dating apps, Tinder, Bumble, OkCupid, some others as well, to promote vaccine awareness. Exact methodology varies. Maybe it'll be a little I'm vaccinated badge or something else. But, you know, whatever works. OkCupid says people who display their vax status in the app are 14% more likely to get a match. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. A report on home sales from the National Association of Realtors today. Prices up, sales down because those prices were up. That is not the news. Limited supply, that is also not the news. Here is the tidbit that got me. The typical home that sold last month spent just 17 days on the market. The quickest things have sold, or I suppose the shortest time on the market in the past 10 years, the group says. Seller's market indeed. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.